Welcome and good afternoon. I'm Michael Verger, Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at Thomas Jefferson University. And I'm pleased to welcome you to the 22nd Annual Dr. Raymond C. Grandin Lecture. I think David Nash started this when he was in high school. I'm honored to once again have the privilege of opening this program. One of our most popular of the Jefferson campus academic year. And each year, the School of Population Health event brings prominent national figures in healthcare to our campus. And a wonderful panel of local reactors who provide their insights and commentary. And you will hear that today. It's always a lively and informative program made possible due to the generosity of a distinguished alumnus of Jefferson Medical College, Raymond Grandin, and his lovely wife, Doris. Raymond Grandin has distinguished himself and brought honor to his alma mater since he graduated from Jefferson Medical College in 1945. From his time as medical student and resident, he began to make his mark to improve the quality of care, promote discussions and collaboration among professionals from different disciplines, and to serve the professional community. I'm happy to say that the Grandins have taken the time to join us today. It's quite a trip for them to venture here to Philadelphia. Earlier today, they helped us celebrate the opening of the relocated Grandin Center at 901 Walnut. And before we begin this formal program, I ask that you join me in a round of applause to acknowledge this outstanding clinician. And his lovely wife for their so many years of service. So on behalf of the Jefferson community, thank you both for helping us to continue this legacy in shaping the future of healthcare. And thank you to all of you in the audience for coming to participate in what I'm sure is going to be a very lively discussion today. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you David Nash, our Dean of the School of Population Health, to begin today's program. David is the force that helped us establish the Jefferson School of Population Health. Under his leadership, JSPH grew from a small department to become a school that is now recognized around the globe. My thanks go out to you, David, and to all of your faculty for this. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. Thanks very much, Mike. It's a wonderful day. We want to thank the Grandins and especially David Grandin, their son. As I told them earlier this morning, they brought the sunshine all the way from the western part of the state to Philadelphia. We have a spectacular day in this beautiful building, surrounded by all of our colleagues. It doesn't get too much better than this. I am very proud to welcome everybody, as Mike noted, to the 22nd anniversary of the Grandin Lecture. Yes, it's true, I started in 11th grade, to be exactly right, but seriously, it's a wonderful event and a highlight of our academic year. Mike is also correct. Earlier this morning, Doris and Ray and I and our entire school, all of our faculty and staff, we had a recognition ceremony. We toasted them with bubbling apple cider. And it was just so great to have them tour our new facility in 901 Walnut. And I would welcome all of you to come and see our beautiful new digs. Well, it is true that 20 years ago or so, we were not tweeting at this event, that's for sure. So if you'd like to follow us along, we're at hashtag JSPH. If you don't know what I'm talking about, we'll have a remedial session later. But hashtag JSPH, and it is amazing when I think about 22 years ago, what's a hashtag, what's the internet? It's pretty incredible. I'm also especially proud that this event is sponsored by our School of Population Health. So you might remember we opened our doors on 9-9-09, so easy date to remember. We're coming up on birthday number 4 come this September. So we have now more than 300-plus students across really the world from 35-plus states and a bunch of countries overseas, all online with us across our four master's degrees and our doctoral program. To see the physical manifestation of what we've grown into, once again, I invite you to the 10th floor of 901 Walnut. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge all the help that we've had because, you know, nobody builds a school by himself. That's for darn sure. So I want to especially thank President Gozen, who unfortunately could not actually be here with us today. But, boy, what a powerful force. Without his support, clearly there'd be no school. And my special thanks to my boss, Mike Vergeer. You know, Mike is a psychiatrist, and he does have a couch in his office. I avail myself of that routinely. So it is great to have a boss you can get therapy from as well. Finally, I want to congratulate this year's winner of the Joseph S. Ganella Scholarship, and that is Mr. Evan Bilheimer, a current Jefferson Medical College student. So the Joe Ganella Scholarship recognizes a joint degree student in Jefferson Medical College and the School of Population Health. And finally, let me give big thanks to Dr. Greg Kane, the entire Department of Medicine, for allowing us to usurp Medicine Grand Rounds for today in this wonderful auditorium. Let me outline the proceedings. As in years past, we follow a pretty successful formula. In a moment, I'll have the privilege of introducing our special guest, Dr. Glenn Steele. At the conclusion of Glenn's formal remarks, I will ask the panel members to come up without any delay and to occupy the seats as labeled in the beautiful brochures that you have in front of you. The panel members are seated up close, so when Glenn is done, please hustle back on up. I hope you'll read the short biography of both Dr. Grandin and Dr. Steele in the beautiful programs you have in front of you. Let me see if I can personalize for a moment Glenn's introduction. So last night at dinner, Glenn shared with us some of the insights he has regarding the growth and the national prominence now of the Geisinger Health System in Danville, Pennsylvania. Glenn has taken Geisinger from a regional power to really maybe a global one, or certainly at least a national powerhouse envied by everybody. He is cited as one of the key leaders across the country as an implementer of health reform, as a real innovator. At the national level, Glenn has been recognized by virtually every major national organization in our business, American Hospital Association, HRET, the information systems people, the Institute of Medicine, the list goes on. So, Glenn, really, you're helping to define the role, in my view, of the physician executive of the future. Last year, for those of you who were here, you remember Mark McClellan from the Brookings Institute. Mark's timing, I thought, was pretty good in 2012 because he helped us to understand what health reform was all about. But I couldn't think of a better speaker in 2013 to help us understand how to implement health reform than Glenn Steele. Glenn, you strike me as the right man in the right job at the right time. You're going to join a very proud pedigree of 21 prior Grandin lecturers. So would you join me in a warm Jefferson welcome for Dr. Glenn Steele?
Thanks very much, David. Dr. and Mrs. Grandin, David Grandin, thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here and to renew friendships, see a number of people that I've been interacting with for decades. The introduction reminds me of the headline at when I first came to Geisinger 13 years ago. Whenever I get a swelled head, I think about that headline. The local newspaper there said, "New CEO, well-traveled." Just thought I'd leave that with you. It's a much more concise way of summarizing a career. What I'd like to do today is give you a brief tour of what I consider to be a perfect experimental model, if you will, for fundamentally attacking a lot of the core issues in healthcare provision and healthcare payment. And I think most of you would agree that ACA, the Obamacare, whatever we define it, really has begun a transformation that is not going to is not going to turn back, but it doesn't answer some of the fundamental problems. We actually have to supply those answers ourselves. And the key question that is going to be percolating through most of your minds during this talk is how much of what I say is applicable anywhere else other than our unusual market with our unusual fiduciary structure in sociology. And I don't have a definitive answer yet for that, but I think we probably will in a few years. So first of all, let me describe what's unusual about us, other than the fact that we're in the middle of Pennsylvania. We're rural, we're semi-rural, we're post-industrial. But the most important aspect is the fiduciary aspect, where we have an insurance company which is quite robust, particularly now that we've made a commitment to do Medicaid managed care as well. A provider group that includes the entire continuum, the entire spectrum of providers, hospital-based, non-hospital-based, community practices, 55 sites, the usual towers, which are hubs, as well as ambulatory campuses as things begin to shift in an ambulatory portfolio. And then we actually, up until recently, had dealt with about 12 non-Geisinger, non-owned hospitals where we accounted for anywhere up to 50 to 60% of the inpatient volume in an attempt to take care of our patients close to where they lived, which is really centrifugal, not sucking them into the big house in Danville or the big house in Wilkes-Barre. Now, recently, a lot of those 11 or 12 non-Geisinger hospitals have found that they no longer have sustainable business models. And so they've come to us or CHS or some other big entity and said, take us, we're yours. And so there's been a fundamental dynamic change, and it's driving towards consolidation. So we are perfectly, and the other thing that you should know is we are not like Kaiser. We have much more heterogeneity than Kaiser in two aspects. First of all, the insurance company represents only about 30% of our commercial payer mix. So we still are getting reimbursed by Capital, Highmark, Northeast Blue Cross, Coventry in the old-fashioned fee-for-service way. And we use the old-fashioned leverage and credibility of our system and our name to get handsome reimbursement in the old-fashioned way from that 70%. So all that you're going to hear about today is the sweet spot of innovation between us as payer and us as provider. And yet we're not betting the whole book of business on that. When things work, we'll spread those things out to all the patients, regardless of whom the payer is. But we're not betting that everything has to work. I have to give a certain amount of the value that's extracted from the reengineering back through our insurance company to the people who are buying the insurance product. And most of those people are medium to small size businesses. And we have to keep our premiums competitive with the much bigger insurance companies that have much bigger risk-based capital, i.e. reserves. So that forces us as a system to try to figure out not only how to create value from the reengineering of care, but how much has to be given back to the buyers. It's a very interesting dynamic. You know where we are. As James Carville said, we're in the part of Pennsylvania that could be called Pennsyltucky. So that's where we are. And it has its charms. We have 55 sites. We have been exclusively an Epic partner in terms of our EHR for 20 years. So the functionality of Epic, particularly the ambulatory functionality, is a huge advantage for us, having been evolved over two decades. We also have reached out to probably now 6,000 non-Geisinger physicians that practice with us and have enabled them with web-based portals into Epic. We move right up on, right up against the antitrust in terms of functionalizing non-Geisinger, non-employed to share an electronic database with us. Now we can do it much more formally through Kihei, And we do it much more formally through our insurance company, which has 20,000 or so non-Geisinger or non-employed physicians in their panel. And a number of our facilities, including the new acquisition in Scranton, are largely populated by non-employed physicians taking care of their patients in that platform. So again, it's a very heterogeneous system, not like Kaiser, where in order to get Kaiser's care, you have to have Kaiser's insurance. Where you get that care is in Kaiser hospitals. We are much more heterogeneous. We are designed as a hub and spoke. We have two hubs that are Geisinger hubs in Danville and in the Northeast in Wilkes-Barre, now with Scranton added to it. And our hub in the West is actually a regional medical center that we don't own in State College, but we account for almost 50% of the inpatient volume. So we are trying to keep patients, again, as decentralized and as close to where they live as possible, unless they need very specialized tertiary or even quaternary care, which is obviously centralized, largely in Danville, but now more and more in Wilkes-Barre. The electronic infrastructure is an enabling infrastructure, which is very expensive. If we bench out our running costs for our electronic health record, it benches at the head of the curve, and yet it is absolutely fundamental. It's absolutely fundamental for the innovation that I'm going to talk to you about, data being fed back in almost real time to the men and women who are actually taking care of the patients so that they know about any potential deviations in real time and can change how their care is being given. Extraordinarily important. And when we talk about the sweet spot between our insurance company and our provider group, and the fact that other organizations are trying to mimic that sweet spot, the real issue is, are they going to be able to have the same almost real-time flow of data? Or is it going to be an after-the-fact reconciliation, 6 months or a year post seeing the patient, taking care of the patient? If we're talking about reconciliation of data, showing how you've done 6 months later or 12 months later, which is quite frankly, the way the ACOs are defined right now and the way CMS is dealing with this, it is not going to work to change how physicians, how nurse practitioners, how PAs, how pharmacists can actually alter their care right now with the patient sitting in front of them. So I think that's very important. The fourth dot there is the future. The fourth dot is a commitment to have what now is a third of our patients actively interacting with us electronically, moved up to probably 50% of the patients over the next couple of years. We think that the activation of human beings is going to be the next major step in how we manage health and how we care for chronic disease. Not so much acute care, but chronic disease and managing health. And that is not going to happen with physical interaction, folks. And it's not going to happen by telephone, telephonic interaction. And I'll give you some vignettes about incremental progress with using a much more active participation of patients electronically in a few minutes. As I mentioned this morning in our free-flowing discussion that David put together, we are very intentional about our strategic goals. And we have three strategic goals that we are constantly iterating and reiterating with our 20,000 family members at Geisinger. And it's quality and innovation as number one, fundamental change in how we care for high frequency hospital-based issues, fundamental change in how we care for high prevalence chronic disease. And of course, expanding and scaling and generalizing is now a new goal, trying to see how much of what we do is applicable to anywhere else. And a much more intentional focus on our family, our Geisinger family, as the most important resource for all of our accomplishments, with a very concrete set of commitments to both personal and professional well-being amongst our own Geisinger family. So I'm sure you would agree with where we are now. The question is, how much does the present healthcare transformation law take us? I would submit to you, it doesn't take us into any significant straightforward change. We have to figure out as a provider community with our own particular structures, our own particular credibility, interest, our own particular missions, how we're going to be able to, within the ACA law, make this change happen in a incremental, non-chaotic way. I would submit to you this is where we want to be, and we could talk about affordable coverage for all on the basis of two things. Number one, it makes sense in terms of a business model, and number two, it's, as far as I'm concerned, an ethical imperative. And that last bullet there is my own personal fantasy. I'm not banking on that one happening while I'm alive. So what's our advantage? What's our advantage? We have a group of physicians and professional staff that are largely at Geisinger right now because they want to be. Nobody has ever said to me when we've been in the middle of a recruitment discussion, you know, I've always wanted to visit Danville. our market is remarkable, particularly in the middle of the market, what I call Shangri-La. In central Susquehanna, we've got a huge market share on both the provider and the payer side. Now, that causes a little angst in the Attorney General's office. It causes angst every time one of these non-viable business models comes to us and says, would you consider us joining your system? And I think that angst is legitimate. If we wanted to take advantage of the economic leverage, we could. And for part of our business, we do. But for the mission of quality and innovation, that huge market share on both sides of the sweet spot gives us a tremendous advantage in terms of taking risk, seeing whether one or another innovation works. People give us the benefit of the doubt largely when we're re-engineering. And that was not the way it was in some of my other venues, where basically people were hoping more that you would fail than you would succeed. And people viewed every success of an institution in Boston as being at the detriment of another institution. We don't have that sociology to contend with, which is really very, very interesting. And then, obviously, the EHR is a tremendous enabler, and the sweet spot. If our group is able to attack total cost of care by doing population risk-taking and population health, it comes right back to our insurance company as a business success. So total cost of care, business success for our insurance company. We don't have, and then we do the internal transfer pricing. So however we got to that benefit in terms of quality and cost, I can do the internal transfer pricing from the business success on the insurance company side to the community practice that deserves it on the provider side. I don't have to negotiate it every year or every 3 years with independents or with capital or with Highmark or what have you. So it's a very important sweet spot. And there's lots of experiments there now trying to reproduce that in various ways. So here are two touchstones. The one touchstone comes from the RAND study in 2003, Beth McGlynn. What Beth showed, and what has been shown a number of times subsequently, is that about 50% of what we do for hospital-based, high-prevalence disease care or for ambulatory chronic disease care either doesn't help the humans that we serve or may hurt them. About 50%. That's what she said. Now, you can quibble with all the methodology that was involved in this. Discount it. Discount it down to 25 or 30%. Doesn't matter. 1/6 of our economy is predicated on 25% of costs that either don't benefit those that we serve or may actually hurt those that we serve. Now, I looked at this and I said, wow, what an upside. What an upside. If we could figure out in one or another experimental model, like Geisinger, and even more so if we could scale re-engineering of what we do and extract that cost, some of that cost, without hurting patients. And by the way, we might see if we could postulate helping patients with this value reengineering and then redistribute that value. We could do a lot with that redistributed value. You could cover anybody you wanted to cover. You could build any programs you wanted to build. But the question was, how do you actually systematically extract that 25, 30, 35, 40% of crap right now that either doesn't help patients or may hurt them? So that's the first part of the religion. And the second part of the religion is this famous Arne Milstein graph, which has shown for years and has been articulated again and again that there is no relationship in this country, whether it's geographic, whether it's by market, whether it's by discipline, no relationship between cost and quality. None. Zero. None. So again, those are the two. Now, we've taken that second Arne Milstein chaos graph and I believe begun to prove that, in fact, if you're looking for a population of patients, whether it's hospital-based or chronic disease, if you're looking for a population that is most likely to have bad outcome, start with the cohort that has the highest cost. It's not 100% correlation, but what we postulate and what I think we've begun to prove is that more often than not, when you re-engineer care, and the main issue is getting rid of unjustified variation, when you re-engineer care and you push towards default best practice, you're doing two things. Number one, you're decreasing cost, and number two, you're increasing the probability of a good outcome for a patient. So that takes most of us who are physicians or professionals trying to help people off the schneid. I mean, if you have to make a choice between quality versus cost extraction, you're going to make a choice for quality. That's a false choice, though. That's a false choice. So anyway, that was religion when we started. It's now becoming a little bit more facts-based with some of the things I'm going to summarize for you in a minute. So our quality and innovation, which is top-down based on our strategy, but is bottom-up based on how particular projects get initiated through our 27 or 28 service lines. And by the way, we pay 20% of total cash compensation to our physicians based on things other than RVUs, based on things other than panel size, based on things other than seeing more patients on a given day. So that 20% is hooked mainly to accomplishing goals that are absolutely bottom-up examples of one or another innovation that I'm going to give you as vignettes today. So here are five categories re-engineering, and I'm going to talk about number one, which is a hospital-based re-engineering. Number two, our approach to kind of remodeling our chronic disease management. And number three, our version of advanced medical home. Our proven care acute programs started back in 2004, 2005 with heart, elective heart surgery and PCI. And we chose heart surgery and PCI for a couple of reasons. Number one, we had great leadership on both cardiology's part as well as cardiac surgery's part. Number two, we had great outcome. Pennsylvania Cost Care Containment Commission had shown our outcome both in terms of quality as well as cost was up there top two or three for all the big programs in the Commonwealth. I didn't want to start with a dog because I thought the probabilities of actually getting this done would be way down. So we wanted to start with something which was good and could hopefully be made even better. The other reason we chose heart was that both the cardiologist as well as the cardiac surgeons through a society called Society of Thoracic Surgery, had done their own prioritization of evidence, prioritization of consensus best practice. So they had that, and we could pick it off the shelf. And the concept was, could we create a process, of defining at the start how much variation we actually had. And then could we drive to a default best practice in terms of indications and in terms of everything that was felt to be most likely to lead to a perfect outcome during the entire episode of care, whether it was preoperative, whether it was in the hospital, and all the way through to rehab. And when we started the process, our cardiologist said, and our cardiac surgeon said, we're different. We're different here at Geisinger. We don't have a lot of variation. We work as a kind of a group practice. We've been here for 100 years. You know, in some cases, Abigail had probably recruited a few of those folks, and we're different. So we did an inventory and found out that we were no different. Huge amount of unjustified variation. Antibiotics chosen, antibiotic start-stop time, anticoagulation regimen, it was all over the map, all over the map. And we said, well, let's have a process where we drive our own group to consensus. And for cardiac surgery, we came up with about 50 things that we would set ourselves on accomplishing for every patient who was undergoing an elective CABG. We started with elective CABG. And for proven perinatal, it's like 150 things that we would set ourselves to accomplish throughout the entire 9 months of the perinatal journey, et cetera, et cetera. And we said, initially, what I said was, if we don't accomplish a single best practice in any patient, any given patient, let's not drop a bill. And I got immediate severe pushback on that, David. Severe pushback. So we compromised. And remember, this is for 30% of our business, because this is the sweet spot where we're both taking care of the patients and we're insuring the patients. So we're not betting the entire book of business. So what we said is, let's come up with a single price, including our financial risk for taking care of any complications that occur. And so we look back at 18 months of our complications and our treatment for those complications, how much it would cost, how much we billed for it, and we basically discounted it by 50%. So what we were betting on with this original package price is that we would improve our outcome by a factor of 2 to break even for that 30% of patients. So it was very interesting. That was the beginning. And what we showed was, now remember, we're already starting with good outcome. We showed that, we had a reasonable number, a reasonable starting point back in 04. It was about 40% or 45% of our patients had gotten all of these best practices, which, by the way, were baked into our EHR. I mean, you couldn't do this with after the fact record review. This had to be in real time. And it's, you know, antibiotic starting, antibiotic stopping, median sternal wound preparation, temperature of the patient when they go out of the operating room to the recovery room, monitoring, continuous monitoring of blood sugar with insulin drip. I mean, it's all basic blocking and tackling stuff, which was off the shelf in terms of consensus, but had never been baked into the process. And what we said is, any physician could deviate from any of these best practice metrics. They just had to justify it in real time to their colleagues. And one of the justifications was not, you know, I was trained a different way 35 years ago. One of the justifications was not, I've had a special message from God. So it was an attempt to attack unjustified variation, but leave enough discretionary capability so that people were not forced into stupid stuff. So as you can see, we got up to almost all of our patients almost all the time. It varies, it's biologic. And we published the first aliquot of data back in 2006, 2007, and we've maintained a really interesting improvement from what started as a good baseline. And as I said before, we've taken this out to all of our patients, regardless of whom the payer is. But remember, if I'm doing better with these patients and they're getting through quicker and they have fewer complications, And for all of those non-Geisinger payers, I'm still using my leverage, and we still have a huge disease burden, so we can backfill. I'm creating value for the system. I'm creating value for the patient, and I'm extracting value from Capital and Highmark and Northeast Blue Cross and Coventry. So it's a very interesting dynamic, very interesting dynamic. And we found that not only, again, were we having a better outcome in terms of the near-term and long-term quality metrics, but we were decreasing what already in the Commonwealth patient care cost containment data, we were improving what already was a pretty good cost comparison. We were improving that dramatically. So costs were going down, quality was going up. And it took us 8 years from the start of that, from 2004 to last year, before we actually got any market affirmation. So none of our other payers called and said, we want in on this. Interesting. Many reasons why, but they didn't. And we worked for 10 years with IBM to try to sell this to their employees. We worked for 3 years with GE to try to sell it to their employees. And we finally got a hit with Walmart, which is the Centers of Excellence. And Walmart has designated us 27 states for elective PCI and heart surgery. They will incent their full-time employees to come to Danville. They'll pay for the patient and a loved one. They'll give $1,000 walking around money. I don't know how much they're saving on their global single price, but we're still making a 20% margin on this, David. So you can, I mean, that just gives you an idea of how much cost is in there that can be extracted to the benefit of the patient. Now, so Chris, does this resonate with you? I mean, it's just incredible. So this is our portfolio right now. And we talked about EPO earlier today. It's very, very similar. You know, one of the real quick wins on this stuff is indications. I mean, just as an example, when we did best practice for EPO for anemia of chronic renal disease, and we applied it and kind of re-engineered our EPO caregiving, we found out that 20% of our patients actually could be treated just as well with iron. Just incredible. And you can imagine. Now, again, when we do that, that's a benefit for patients, because all of you who are clinicians understand that EPO doesn't come without complications. So it's not just the cost that you're going after, it's the quality of the outcome as well. And that comes straight to the benefit of our insurance company, because total cost of care goes down and we can figure out how the internal transfer pricing should be done to benefit those who are actually changing the care, which is our physicians, our nurse practitioners, what have you. So a vignette about the chronic disease management change. These are the prevalent chronic diseases that we've gone after by paying a significant amount, up to 20% of our total cash compensation, to our community practitioners, our primary care physicians, and in the case of diabetes, to some of our endocrinologists as well, for hitting a series of best practice metrics for our type 2 diabetic patients. About 25,000 type 2 diabetics are starting point with very good primary care physicians in EHR-enabled systems, highly productive. You know, when you look at best practice off-the-shelf metrics thought to be related to best outcome for a diabetic over time, 2.4%, incredible. And we've ramped it up. This was community practices' major innovative target over a number of years. Now we're into COPD, we're into coronary artery disease, into hypertension, what have you. So the mode here, the mode of success is, for most of these 25,000, 7, 8, or 9. I mean, 99% of our type 2 diabetics have 7, 8, or 9 metrics hit. There are a number of contraindications for some metrics being achieved, like A1C for patients who are 70 and older with heart disease. You don't want to whack it down below 7. So, you know, there's a reason for not having all of the metrics hit. But what we found, and this will be published in the American Journal of Managed Care, in a month or so, what we found, which is truly amazing to me, is that after 3 years of steady state treating our diabetics this way, we had a significant decrease in the probability of myocardial infarction, of stroke, of retinopathy, and also we've now looked at nephropathy of Kimmel-Steel-Wilson disease. And we haven't even done the economics on this yet, but you can imagine what the economics are. So if you're a diabetic and you have the ability to look at some sort of a data sheet and show that if you go to system A, you have X chance of a heart attack or a myocardial infarction or a stroke, and if you go to system B after 3 years of a different way of being cared for, you have a significant decrease in that problem. What would you choose? I mean, it is absolutely mind-boggling. And we're now applying this to another three or four very prevalent chronic diseases. And now let me just end with a brief vignette in terms of our version of Advanced Medical Home. What we have done is ask the insurance company to pay for nurses who are embedded in our community practices. We have 240 or 250 PCPs in community practices, primary care physicians in community practices, and we are convinced that not only do those PCPs respond to more total cash compensation, which they're getting and which they deserve, but they respond to a fundamental reorganization of how they are expected to care for patients. And one of the key components of our version of Advanced Medical Home is to have a nurse be responsible for 125 to 150 of the highest utilizing chronic disease aggregate patients in each practice. So nothing can happen to that patient without it being triaged through the nurse. This is concierge care for the sickest, not concierge care for the richest. And for us, it makes sense in two ways. Number one, if we can do better care, and this is a group of patients generally around 75 years of age with diabetes, hypertension, coronary artery disease, reactive depression. The average number of meds that they take is 20 to 25 a day. These are the patients that are bouncing in and out of the hospital. These are the patients that gain 7 pounds of weight on a Friday evening, come to our emergency rooms, and they're admitted for a tune-up, right? And it happens every 30 to 90 days. And then, God forbid, they get an HAI, and et cetera, et cetera. So this is, again, I mean, it's not rocket science, but it's hard as heck transaction. So the other task of these nurses that are embedded, paid for by the insurance company, embedded in the community practice, is that they bring the predictive modeling, they bring the real-time utilization data into the community practices, and they customize it so that it can be used by the practice leader, who's always the PCP, always the primary care physician. Because most of the time, when you get information from insurance companies, whether it's in a specialty practice or a community practice, you know, it's a huge spreadsheet. It's not easily used. If you're working very hard to maintain your patient load, it's going to go into the wastebasket or be ignored. So there's two major functions of these folks. Now, all of that reengineering, together with our commitment to bundled best practice, as exemplified by the type 2 diabetes example, has led to dramatic and sustainable decreases in admissions per 1,000 and readmissions per 1,000. A huge decrease, which, by the way, is probably related to some of the recent unsustainability of the business model of some of those smaller hospitals that we were dealing with out in the smaller communities. So it's probably related. It's probably related. The cumulative effect, now you remember before Obamacare was passed, we were having national conversations about a 1% bending of the cost curve over a 10-year period. Our cost curves for our Medicare population and our commercial population that are involved in this Advanced Medical Home have yearly gone down 7%. 7%. Now, once again, you know, that's, for us, number one, it's important because the patients are doing better. They're doing better. And number two, the business benefit of that comes straight to our insurance company because it's an attack on total cost of care. It's extracting a lot of that 30 to 40% of cost that doesn't benefit human beings. And I get to redistribute it. Some of it has to go back in lower premiums to the companies that we're selling insurance product to. But some of it goes to the men and women who are making the difference, because I can do the internal transfer pricing with regulatory and market-based stringency, but still, I can do it. And the question is, how do you approximate that relationship in a different fiduciary where you're dealing quite often with dominant payers that are not necessarily interested in changing? I think our next VISTA is going to be a significant distribution of our technology and distribution of our responsibility outside the big house, whether the big house is Jefferson or whether the big house is GMC in Danville. And we're doing that in the usual way, EICUs. A lot of people do EICUs and they actually don't change the patterns of care and the sociology. It doesn't work. We're doing it with fundamental experiments, asking questions about moving away from the following default. In general, and all of you have experienced, in general, if you have a PCP call and say, I've got a patient with really, really bad congestive failure, or if I have a diabetic who's extraordinarily fragile, more often than not, the default for a good specialist, hospital-based, is send him to me, I'll see him today. I'll clear my schedule, I'll see him today. We've actually tried to turn that around. We tried to figure out how to get the intellectual property from the hospital-based specialist out to the community practice, a fundamental change. And we've had some success in a number of areas. We're also trying to figure out how you pay for that intellectual property transmission. It's a separate, very, very difficult exercise. But those are the things that we're committed to right now as we move ahead. And this vignette here, I think, is one of the most eye-opening and important things that's happened for the last year. We did an experiment where we opened up for 8,800 of our patients and 24 of our primary care physicians, opened up all of our progress notes electronically, all of our progress notes to our patients and whatever surrogate they agreed to be able to read the notes. And the world did not end. The world did not end. Huge amount of interest, a huge amount of activity on this. The number of hits on this was amazing, amazing. 50% of the records had significant errors in them. 50%. And you know what? They were corrected because the patients corrected them. So it's like any data that you use, it gets better if you use it. And lawyers were not involved. We have had no lawsuits from this. No, I'm serious. It's a way of partnering. It's a way of partnering. We've had early indication that one of the most difficult things about chronic disease management, which is medication adherence, may actually be improved by this. So this year, we're taking this out. We're taking this out to our entire staff. All of our medical records will be open. All of our progress reports to all of our patients. We're even doing that in orthopedics. So our orthopedists are very, very productive, but sometimes it's kind of like having them around the table in a davening session, you know, when you're trying to move things ahead. It's fascinating. But they're great guys and girls. Again, the question is how do we approximate the sweet spot when you don't have a payer in your fiduciary? How do you do that? Particularly when your dominant payer is not interested in doing this kind of relationship. And we have some ideas about that. I think, you know, I predict that when the ACOs start to recon the results, I predict that there'll be winners and losers, but I'm not sure we'll know why we won or why we lost. I think it'll be somewhat chaotic. And so I think Medicare Advantage is going to expand dramatically because there you can get data from your commercial HMO in a way that is real time, at least much more real time than CMS. But I think there will be less revenue as well. Medicaid managed care, Medicaid is going to expand more than any other payer. But as you'll read in the New England Journal article that came out today online, expanding Medicaid and covering more people doesn't automatically lead to better health. It'll lead to more cost, but it won't necessarily lead to better health unless we do the kind of reengineering that we're talking about here. There will be less revenue. And I think as we drop down to the bottom of the slide, I think it's highly likely, particularly if the utilization goes up, as it will when you see what happened in Oregon, and we don't take this cost out quick enough, I think the next simple answer politically will be global budgets for all healthcare expenditures, state by state. And those budgets will say something like, providers, we're going to give you X amount of money, which will be 0.5% more than state GDP, very similar to what Massachusetts is trying to do. You all figure out how to divvy it up. And what it'll do if we do global budgets, it takes away cost shifting. It takes away our own hedge in terms of being able to do what we do with capital and Highmark and Northeast and what have you. So that'll really put the rubber to the road in terms of our applying our sweet spot across the board and really decreasing cost for everything. So increase access, increase demand, kind of a schizophrenic, how do you manage the residual fee-for-service, which still for us is dominant, plus these new population health risk incentives, smells like capitation, looks like capitation, won't be called capitation. But how do you do both? I think we have an interesting idea of how to do that. Whether it's applicable or not, we'll see. And the bottom line is, you know, we still have all this fiscal cliff stuff, and it's all going to be landing on Medicare and Medicaid. Absolutely, no question about it. And my favorite slide, which is a surgical data slide, is we're going to be moving to population health, or we're going to be doing fee-for-service with less and less reimbursement per unit of work. And you do not want to be the hamster. I'll just do that one more time, in case you haven't gotten it. That's my surgical data slide. So I said to David, and David, by the way, I'm really, really honored by being invited here. It's great to talk to bright people, and everybody's got their own, you know, their own issues and governance issues and what have you. But you know, you're thinking about doing the right thing. You're trying to do the right thing. And what we're trying to do is to answer the next really important question, which is about scaling and generalizing. And we can conceptualize it, we can talk theoretically about it, but there's nothing like real experiments. I love real experiments. They may be small, they may be incremental steps. But we've taken our insurance company outside of Pennsylvania. We've taken it to West Virginia with West Virginia University, a demography similar to ours, but with an academic overlay. We've taken it to Eastern Maine Medical Center, which is very, 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 very advanced and has a market share similar to ours. We've taken it to New Jersey with Meridian. We've taken it to Delaware, and we're about to take it to Orlando, Florida, and we've taken it actually overseas. I don't want to mention where because it's so weird. But the issue here is, can we, working under the radar, can we, even though we're not anywhere near the dominant payer, can we work with a preferred provider that is really interested in getting this sweet spot in a way that will really enable innovation without necessarily poking a finger into the eye of the preferred of the dominant payer? And it's very interesting. But we have good results. We've been 2 years in West Virginia, very good utilization results. We have early good results in Maine, And if we can, you know, there are ways of incrementalizing the experiment. You can start with self-insured and dependents. Then you could do a self-insured joint venture selling to companies. And then the big plunge is risk, whether we do a joint venture for risk. But there are various ways of incrementalizing and hedging the bet. The other much more straightforward scaling that we've done is taking this into markets that are not like Shangri-La. So Scranton is not like Shangri-La in central PA. We've got a lot of wonderful docks there, but they're terminally conditioned to fee-for-service. And the question is, are we going to be able to figure out, without directly employing them, because we don't employ any of them at that hospital, are we going to be able to figure out ways of enabling and incenting? And that, you know, that's a big experiment which is underway. Now, it worked in Wilkes-Barre. It took us about 2 to 3 years. And there was also consolidation of the market that helped, so there are obvious business advantages. But, you know, I figure I've got 2 to 3 more years to see whether we can do this in Scranton. And in a few other places that are outside of our contiguous market. And then the final engine for scaling is a business that we started where we've extracted the care management, data analytics, the predictive modeling, and the bolt-on functions that for 20 years we've been developing on Epic. We've taken all that out of our provider and our payer company. And with a joint venture with a wonderful lady, Oak Investments, Annie Lamont, we've actually created a company that is being run by a guy named Earl Steinberg in order to try to expand our capacity, market discipline it, sell it to others, and by the way, sell it back to our own insurance company, probably with a much more efficient product, better product. So, it's great interacting with you. I appreciate the honor. Dr. Grandin, I don't think I could have gotten that differential that you went over with me at lunch on the eye situation, but it was fascinating. And thank you very much for listening, folks.
Well, I know some of us have to go and actually take care of patients, so we'll give them a moment to get back to their clinical duties. I'll ask the panel members if they could come up forward now, please. Great. Well, Glenn, first of all, one more round of applause for Glenn Steele. Woo! The $10 I gave him at breakfast to say population health 5 times really paid off. So outstanding work. Well, Glenn, we appreciate that, and also right on schedule, which I surely appreciate. Let's turn now to the reactor panel, which is a wonderful tradition of the Grandin Lectureship. I want to give attribution here for 1 minute to Dr. Joe Gonella, who, after the first Grandin Lecture, said, you know, maybe instead of taking questions from the audience, we ought to pick some faculty members to react to the talk extemporaneously. So we established this tradition now nearly 20 years ago. So here's the rules of the road. So despite their best efforts, all the panelists have not seen Dr. Steele's slides prior. They all tried, believe me, David McQuaid especially. I could be very wealthy right now. So I'm going to ask each of them in turn to give an extemporaneous, from the heart, no more than 8 minute reaction to Glenn's presentation. And I want you all to understand that I've asked each of them, not in their formal roles, but as an individual, as an expert, as a practitioner, as a leader, what they thought of Glenn's remarks. Now, to create the panel, we seek a broad representation from really across our entire community, both on and off campus. So let me introduce them as they're listed in your beautiful brochures. So first, Dr. Jennifer Bilotta is an assistant professor in the Jefferson School of Nursing. Now, she's had a distinguished career both in nursing and health administration. We really love Jennifer. She's on the editorial board of our flagship journal, Population Health Management. So Jennifer, great to have you be a part of this. Sitting next to Jennifer is Jane Crowley. Now, Jane is a visitor, and she is also the executive vice president of Catholic Health Partners, one of the leading national, multi-state integrated delivery systems in our whole country, headquartered in Cincinnati, Ohio. I had the privilege of working side-by-side with Jane for a decade as a member of the Board of Trustees of Catholic Health Partners, having finished my service there in 2010. So, Jane, you traveled the furthest for today, and we appreciate that. Sitting next to Jane is our very own Dr. Drew Harris. Drew is the director of the Jefferson School of Population Health Program in Health Policy. Drew is also a clinician trained in public health. He has provided outstanding leadership, having joined us just a little over a year ago for our online program in health policy. Of course, sitting next to Drew, a guy who needs no introduction for this crowd, is our very own David McQuaid, president of Thomas Jefferson University Hospital and one of the key leaders on our campus. David, also a clinician, has led a campus-wide, clinical system-wide implementation of practice protocols. He's done this with a lot of help, but it's been David's leadership to reduce, as you heard Glenn say over and over, reduce unexplained clinical variation. David is a special guest today because he's been a Grandin reactor in the past. For those of you who keep track of this sort of thing, he was on the stage when John Aguinobi, the chief medical officer of Walmart, gave the Grandin lecture in 2008. Finally, Dr. Laura Pizzi, an associate professor in our very own School of Pharmacy here on campus in the Department of Pharmacy Practice. Laura is also on the editorial board of one of our other publications from our school, the American Health and Drug Benefits. Laura is a recognized national expert in health economics and outcomes research. So as is our custom, we're going to go right down the line, starting with Jennifer. I'll watch the clock, no more than 8 minutes. And Glenn, if we have sufficient time, I may ask you to come back and react to the reactor panel, depending on the provocative nature of their comments and how much time and energy the audience has. So Jennifer, set a high bar. Let's get started.
No pressure at all. Well, first I want to say thank you, David, for inviting me.
You are welcome.
I'm both honored and humbled to be part of this panel, and a little bit intimidating. So as your nurse reactor, I'm, of course, going to speak about nursing. And I thank Dr. Steele for Geisinger's ongoing support of the Pennsylvania Action Coalition. That is an initiative that comes out of the Center to Champion Nursing and a direct result of the Future of Nursing Report put out by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Institute of Medicine a few years ago. So as a nursing instructor, I can tell you, and as a nurse myself, that nurses are trained and equipped to execute the beautiful model that was laid out by Dr. Steele. And for years, we've been practicing at a primary care level, working with prevention, patient education, different behavioral modifications with our patients. This is what we do, and this is what nursing is educated to execute. So it's unfortunate that this is not more of a Q&A, because I would like to know more about the defined role of the nurse in the model, and perhaps we can talk about that later. But there are a number of areas where that are near and dear to my own heart. Personally, error, the potential for medical error and care coordination between the inpatient and outpatient, as well as maintenance of patient health areas. I think that's critical, and I know you touched upon that a bit, and the nurse's role of care in care coordination and execution in the advanced patient-centered medical home. My other concern is that for years, professionally, it's been a somewhat of a policy minefield and so much of a professional battlefield, often between doctors and nurses, unfortunately, focused too much, in my opinion, on credentials and education and who is providing care, when really where the focus should be is on the outcomes, of course, of patient care. So rather than engaging in ongoing turf wars and turf battles, I think it behooves us as a healthcare providers to really look at the tools that we have and the resources in our toolbox, well beyond certainly just looking at credentials of our providers, and really using the resources we have to their greatest extent. And of course, as a nursing representative, I would advocate the use of a nurse, both in advanced practice and at the bedside, to implement evidence-based practice initiatives and patient care that extends beyond the acute care setting. I'm curious to know also about any barriers of integration across the professions here. If we have a chance to address it, that would be great. And I yield the floor.
Great. Thank you very much, Jennifer. Great job. Jane Crowley.
Thank you, Jennifer, and good afternoon, everyone. I'll start by saying that I agree with Dr. Steele that the Affordable Care Act is both fundamental and now inexorable. It will move forward. But it is also essentially insufficient, as he said. And I think that as a partial solution, the rest, I agree with him, the rest is up to us. And the consequences are quite high. If we, the profession of healthcare, don't make these changes, which need to occur at the care level, at the payment level, and at the organizational level, The consequences will not be pretty. Dr. Steele predicted massive rate cuts, a UK-style budgeting, an absolute limit to the certain amount of resources that will be committed. And we are fundamentally, culturally not prepared to make those choices. Anytime any state in this nation has tried, any society has tried, to put forth even evidence-based limits on what we as consumers should have an absolute right to, we have fundamentally failed. All you have to do is look at the mammography and PSA recommendations to understand the sort of cultural, visceral reaction to any degree of limits. We have a broader experience to look to. The managed care movement in the early 90s did in fact bend the cost curve. But what happened, we all remember, is that it came at too high a price in terms of provider and patient or consumer choice. In general, none of us were willing to give up that degree of professional or personal autonomy in directing our own health care. And as soon as the economy improved, we backed away from what was viewed to be draconian control by remote, impersonal bureaucrats sitting in a WellPoint building somewhere that had nothing to do with medicine. So I think if we understand that the consequences of not changing are quite dire, we also as a nation cannot continue to afford to spend 17% of our GDP for lousy results, right? Less than we expect of ourselves. Whether you look at the microsystem level, Dr. Steele admitted that he was surprised to find, his surgeons were surprised to find so much variation in their own practice, or you look at it at the population level where we should be embarrassed to publish our public health level results in terms of neonatal deaths or longevity or compressed morbidity or any of those statistics that you'd like to review. But if we don't make the changes at those three levels, that's in fact where we're headed. So the beacon organizations, Geisinger among them, are showing us the roadmap. And I think I would offer that in his own humility, Dr. Steele admits that some of this work is not rocket science. So the idea, for example, that a nurse, an advanced practice, the ambulatory nurse, knows how to counsel and prepare patients for the transition from hospital to home and knows how to help newly diagnosed diabetics get on a path to controlling those five key elements that were listed. So I think we have to seriously examine why, what are the barriers to a more rapid spread of this knowledge? One of them is organizational, and that sometimes is the hardest to attack. We spend about 30% of that whopping 17% of the GDP just running the place. And I'm a professional just run the place person, so I'm quite sensitive to there's too many of us, and there's too many structures. Dr. Steele described what's happening in central and northeast Pennsylvania, and it's happening all over the country. Very rapid consolidation of the hospital sector. You see this in the private practice of medicine. Some I have heard say rather provocatively that the private practice of medicine is a dinosaur. It won't be around. And I think certainly many of us agree if you qualify that statement by saying small private practice of medicine will not be around, say five providers or less. Certainly physician groups that are organized and are successful at the 100 or 200 or 300 person level have the capacity to survive. And in fact, in some markets, like Paducah, Kentucky, they're leading the way. They're making the changes, and the hospitals are scrambling to respond. But the days of a few providers hanging out a shingle, borrowing a little bit of money, calling their insurance provider for malpractice coverage, and buying a laptop computer, they're gone. They're over. There's not going to be that kind of practice. So this form of fundamental organizational redesign is a part, it's a very messy part of the gigantic transformation that has to occur. And it is, in my view, not thought about and discussed enough. I'll close by saying that many of you may have read David Brooks's op-ed piece Monday, where he predicted massive chaos across the country. We won't survive the insurance exchange is coming up in October, and the whole healthcare industry is going to collapse, and I just think he's dead wrong. So, but it is up to us, and if we don't move and we don't act at the micro level and the macro level, we won't like what is done to us when the consequences come to be paid. Thank you.
Great, Jane. Thanks so much. I feel the foundation shaking right now. Okay, Drew Harris.
Thank you all for putting me up here, and it is a pleasure. And I really, so I'm supposed to give a reaction, so my reaction is positive, extremely positive. And I think what the points that Glenn was making, what's going on to Geisinger, puts a lie to the argument that this can't be done. There are a lot of people in this country who say, well, we cannot bend the cost curve. Well, there's real proof that it can be done, that there's already, we Americans expect a certain level of health care, and no way we're going to change that. And I think that it can be done. You can provide high-quality care at a much lower cost. It also puts a lie to the argument that somehow we can empower the patient by giving them the power of the purse, that they can make better decisions if we just put more of the burden on the patients to choose doctors and providers, systems that are going to provide better care for them, that somehow that will provide the feedback to lower the costs. This is, even as he describes as being simple in some respects, but for the average individual, incredibly complicated. They cannot marshal the forces. They cannot be the quarterback of the team that's put on the field to take care of them. They have to rely on others, experts, to do that for them. And I don't think that individuals will be in any kind of position to make those kinds of decisions that will help improve their own health outcomes. Now, as an academic, I'm used to asking a lot of questions, so maybe put a few questions out there. And as far as Geisinger has gone, I'm curious as to what they're doing in terms of the population health focus. We understand that so much of what makes us sick is determined by things outside of our own control or decisions, behavioral decisions we make long before we actually come down with the disease. The communities we live in, the environment, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the places where we work and play, all of those have a significant impact on our health outcomes. So what is the Geisinger system doing to improve those health outcomes? How involved is it in public policy to try to make communities that help support people and change the context in which the decisions are made? Things that can be done that we are doing here in Philadelphia, menu labeling, encouraging more walking and biking, creating public spaces that are more amenable to active living. All those things have a significant impact on our health outcomes. And is it the obligation of healthcare providers to get involved in that policymaking process to make sure that those conditions are being changed? Or is it enough to just wait for the people to come into the door and do a really good job once they come in there and take good care of them once they leave to make sure they don't come back again, but not really dealing with those larger issues? And the real question for everyone in the health professions is, how far afield do we go? How involved do we get in more broadly? Another thought that occurred to me is that cultural idea, and you described it well, as a sociology that's going on. And I see it from two different perspectives. First, from the medical education perspective, all of the students who are here are wondering what's the world going to be like for them in the future. And I don't know if I have the answer, but I'd like to find out who does, because the way we train the physicians, especially, is in a certain type of behavior, a certain not a strong team approach, whereas the demand now is going to be on physicians, leaders, and other clinicians who are able to truly change and manage whole teams of people. And what kind of skills and what kinds of technology are they going to have to be conversant in order to survive that new world, recognizing that it's not going to be about solo practice anymore. That's gone. And the other cultural aspect, and I'll close with this point, is the aspect of the patient, and which I've not heard any mention of. What are the expectations of that patient, and are we managing those expectations in a way where they understand that they're getting more for less, or they're getting more of an outcome for less care? When they're used to the fee-for-service model for so long, where they just keep throwing more tests at them, more treatment, and somehow quantity equated with quality, when in fact we're going to be moving in the other direction. And are we doing things to manage patients' expectations? And Jay mentioned the point about what are we doing with mammography expectations and suddenly changing how we're doing testing on people and seemingly taking something away from them, when in fact we're doing something that makes them healthier and provides better outcomes for the entire population. But from as experienced from the individual level, it looks like they're being deprived of something. So really that cultural change that has to occur, and maybe circling back to the policymakers and what we need to do, we need to make sure that our policymakers don't use those missed expectations as a way to attack the future changes. We need to call them out when they challenge the science that's behind all of this, when they challenge that people who are trying to do a better job of improving quality care, and when they call things like death panels, which are really just efforts to try to improve the quality and quantity of care that we give people. And we need to call them out when they do that, and all of us need to be involved in that process. Thank you.
Great. Drew, thanks very much. David McQuaid.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, David. Thank you for inviting me. And Dr. Steele, thank you for being here today at Jefferson. And really, as I thought about it, thanks for being a pioneer, because it really takes guts to go there. And as I thought about this, as the leader for Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals, I have to begin to think about, in answering that question, you know, is it scalable? Is it generalizable? And you know, the answer to that is that it's complicated. It depends. We are not a vertically integrated system where we own all the component pieces and parts. We are not in the insurance business per se. But I want to back up to James' comment, because I too read the David Brooks April 25th op-ed piece. If you haven't seen this, I love David Brooks. I pick up a lot of great key phrases that I use, because I think he's just a wonderful writer. But what he was responding to was, or writing about in his editorial, was the implementation of ACA, okay? And he had a great quote. He said, we're going to be in for a few years of shambolic messiness I loved it. During which time he said, everyone will scramble and adjust, and eventually we're going to settle into a new normal. And then he closes out, you know, his long editorial and by saying that when you choose to build complex, it takes a while to work through the consequences. So as I begin to think about, meanwhile, back at the ranch, what are we doing? There's carefulness because we are moving from this fee-for-service world to fee-for-value world. And so when I say it depends, and then you layer on top of that the rate at which the implementation is taking place because of the government deficit and the significant impacts to an institution like Jefferson and other large systems. And frankly, it goes something like this. It's you know, all in, we're, you know, 2.1 billion organization with the university and Jefferson University physicians. And when April 1st came and we're looking at sequestration, we already take a 2% Medicare hit, already hitting the bottom line, probably worth $2 million this year, annualized $6 million. We're looking at significant dish cuts that could be anywhere in the range of $10 to $12 million in October. There's a list of other impacts, documentation and coding offset, and not to mention, you know, the Simpson-Bowl Commission on graduate medical education, and that could mean $43 million in reductions for graduate medical education. So you start doing the math on this, and you start to scramble, a la David Brooks, and you begin to think about this, and we're always cost conscious, and we're always you know, looking at how we can impact these things. But to get to Medicare break even at this institution, it's probably reductions in, 250 to 300 plus million dollars just to Medicare break even. And so, again, back to the question, you know, is it the case that you can take this model? I believe you can take that model, but you have to be strategically thinking about the model that you're in and the model that you're moving to. And you would have to make some assumptions that you would be taking on some risk. And so some would say, well, are you building an accountable care organization? If you're going to be taking on more risk, do you have really good clinical and economic provider alignment? I had noticed earlier in the room, Dr. Rich Wender, I was going to recognize him because as I look at our patient-centered medical home model, Dr. Wender has been, you know, one of the leaders in the country. And so you need that and a strong primary care presence. He mentioned the compatibility and integration of IT systems. That is absolutely essential. I think about the ownership and the contractual relationships across the continuum, including the post-acute care. So then I think about geographic scope and you know, can do you have scale? The systematic clinical protocols, we've been doing a lot of work internally with that. And I believe in taking out that variation is critically important. But on the insurance side and on looking at analytic capabilities, I think that's going to be very, very important. But actuarial, predictive modeling, all of these types of things that go with the insurance side of the equation, and then importantly, you know, the physician infrastructure. I would tell you that it does get very, very complicated. You know, good intentions gone bad or unintended consequences. We, in fact, are one of the hospitals that actually works with Geisinger in the CMS Center of Innovation, their Bundled Payment for Care Improvement Project. And Geisinger is a convener in that. And more than a year ago, there were guidelines to get some, for institutions like us, some experience with a bundled payment. There have been several iterations since that, and we are still continuing to hear from CMS, and the conveners are, waiting on responses on some of the changes that happen month to month on the impact of taking on some of this risk. So I do believe that there are components of this, but for organizations, traditional organizations, traditional health systems across the country, I think the challenge is really thinking through that strategy, the ability to take on risk in whatever model that is, and getting closer to vertical integration so that you can control more in a very systematic way like Geisinger does.
Great. David, thank you very much. Laura Pizzi, batting cleanup.
So first of all, thank you very much, David, for inviting me today to this Accomplished Reactor panel. When you first came up to the mic, you said this was your 20th Grandin lecture. You were in 11th grade at the time. Well, this is my 13th Grandin lecture, and I was in 5th grade at
the
time.
There you go. Okay.
So I have actually provided some comments structured in two ways. So I am initially am a pharmacist by training, and I actually train future pharmacists in the School of Pharmacy here at Jefferson. But in addition to that, I have a perspective of being a pharmaco and health economics researcher, and the set of comments that I have are a bit different when I take that perspective. So let me start by my response as a pharmacist and pharmacist educator. Dr. Steele, you used this term value reengineering. When I heard that term, I got very excited because I actually feel that pharmacists have long been value engineers in our healthcare system. And in fact, I look at our model of care here at Jefferson, and I think our pharmacy department is really phenomenal in terms of the leadership that they've provided to clinical decision support and really helping to engineer the processes of care to make them more efficient in making sure that the right patient gets the right drug at the right time. So what in the past, maybe some have viewed or mislabeled this as pharmacists being perhaps too process-oriented or maybe too much of a gatekeeper. So it's interesting because that really, I think, was a negative that was pointed out about the profession in the past. But now, with the post-reform era, it seems to me that the pharmacist involvement and model of care, which is again more value-based, hopefully will start to be a broader model for the rest of our healthcare system. my other comment, putting on the pharmacist hat, was the idea about value engineering and its importance to reducing total costs and reducing variation. So we know that this is obviously very important. We all seek to reduce variation in the care processes. Yet, we also know that there's an increasing number of very high-cost specialty drugs that are coming out into the market. And even when we target those specialty drugs to the patients who truly are the best candidates and in need, that we just can't help to have variation no matter what we do. And I was curious to know at Geisinger, if you have time to comment, how or if you have any strategies or ideas regarding how your organization has tackled this specialty drug issue. So shifting gears, putting on my hat as a health economics researcher, let me first admit to being very jealous of your data. I have peripherally been observing.
We can make a deal.
Good. I've been observing the data evolve over the past 5 years. In fact, I was commenting before that I had met Jim Peters at a pharmacoeconomics conference. He runs their data management arm. And I've really watched that data get more and more sophisticated and refined each year. So it's very exciting. Of course, we know that, of course, the data are getting much better with time. Our technology, our systems are getting better. It certainly seems, based on the characteristics you outlined, you have a very sophisticated system at Geisinger. Yet, one of the major challenges, which I don't think we've fully addressed, is about the manpower that's required to actually harness this data. In my world, as a researcher, we live and breathe by grant dollars. And yet, the need seems to now be to kind of move away, perhaps, from that type of model and actually have internal staffs of this type of analytics, which are using the data and can act in a quick enough manner to inform before the health system changes again, because as David McQuaid said, it's moving just so fast. Another area that I was sort of wondering about was with the data, if it's better enabled you to engage in performance-based contracting. I'm certainly hearing from a lot of my colleagues, especially those who work in Europe, that performance-based contracting in pharmaceuticals is becoming more popular. And I would guess that, or you would think, that having more sophisticated data would enable you to better engage in those performance-based types of contracts. Yet it really hasn't played out here, and I would think that a place like Geisinger might be a good place to start with that type of endeavor. And then my last comment, putting on the researcher hat, is you commented about the incredible results you had from your diabetes management program, the 13 to 25% reduction in MI and stroke. And you said, you know, you haven't even seen the cost data yet. And so a question that I have about that is, while the cost data during the period of your analysis might look very favorable, we have to collectively acknowledge that we're aging as a population. And you have somewhat of a captive population there at Geisinger, so these folks perhaps might be more likely to stay in your system. So I do wonder if we show that our cost decreased within one frame of reference or one period of time, are we essentially just sort of kicking the can down the road for costs that are eventual? And that eventually we may have to collectively acknowledge that living longer just costs us more. So those are my key points. Again, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Great. How about a round of applause for all our panel members? Glenn, I'm going to ask you if you'd be willing to address some of the questions that the panel members raised. That would be great. You want to come on up?
First of all, thanks to the panel, you did remarkably well, considering that the data was kept from you.
Yeah, we didn't have the slide.
It's amazing. If you noticed, Jennifer, on the categories of innovation, transitions in care was one of our big categories, and I didn't talk about that. I didn't have time to talk about it, but it's a huge issue whenever there's a passing off, whether it's doctor to doctor, inpatient, outpatient, outpatient, inpatient. That's where screw-ups are quite likely to occur, and our, you know, our Pat Weber and our care managers, who are all nurses, do a huge amount of good for that, and we could talk about that for another hour. Our discipline interaction at Geisinger is perfect. Now to Jane. Well, it's actually pretty. Our discipline interaction is actually remarkable, and the sociology of that, particularly not so much the Northeast. Northeast is different, but in the middle, the sociology is really remarkable. Human beings that we care for, that we're responsible to, really do still respect doctors. Nursing is, in particular, and nursing is thought to be a great career, probably even better than investment banking, which is just an amazing, it's an amazing environment to be in. And that helps us, because people don't feel so much under pressure. And we're actually functioning to look at outcome. And part of the reengineering of care is is to ignore discipline-based or economic territoriality, and we can get away with that a little bit better because we're isolated. So, and Jane, the question of choice that you brought up is really interesting, and I think if we had, and this came up with a couple of you, if we had a simple, uniform, understandable set of outcome criteria, and I'm saying understandable by regular human beings, not those of us who are in the system, I just can't imagine that the major lever for choice would be, if I'm a diabetic, let me choose to be taken care of by a system where I have less chance of having a stroke or less chance of having retinopathy or nephropathy. What we don't have yet is a uniform, simplified way of transmitting that. I mean, most of the time, systems don't even know what their results are. So we're just at the inception of that. But if we, you know, I tend to believe people are not stupid. They just are functioning in a very complex kind of box where there's not uniform data. So I think people now are sniffing out that they're not getting what they should get for the money that's spent. That's where we are right now. And they don't know how to make the next step, but I think we should work together to kind of change the lever that determines choice, not what was advertised by, what was that advertisement that when Hillary Care went down, it was Louise and Harry and Louise. You remember that? Yeah. I mean, that was very effective demagoguery, yeah. But it was incredible. Drew. Patient expectation management, very, very interesting. Again, I believe that the more we can interact with patients as true partners, in particularly in chronic disease management, secondary prevention, the better off we're gonna be. And I think it's, you know, what we're focusing on is two major behavior targets. The one is the behavior target for providers, not just docs, but docs, nurses, pharmacists, PAs, all the people that we have involved. And there's huge change that we're in the midst of experimenting with. But the other is the behavior of the patients. And part of our hospital-based reengineering is actually a very systematic set of patient compacts that tells our patients and their families what we expect ourselves to provide and what we expect them to provide. Now, we had to go through tons of legal expertise about this, as you might imagine, but we call them compacts, not contracts. But it's pretty explicit when we're finished what is expected on both sides, but much more important is what's implicit. What's implicit is the fact that you and we will work together to achieve perfection. And that if we don't, which is obviously going to be the case some of the time because it's a very complex thing that we do, we still think we'll benefit from establishing a relationship where we work together to achieve as close to perfection as we can get. And that's implicit, but I think is more important than the explicit stuff that's on there. And then the concept that David brings up, which is, I think you were trying, David, to figure out how what I said could possibly connect to Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And I have to say, first of all, we're delighted if CMS can ever get their damned act together. This is the David Brooks thing. I'm delighted that we're working together for this acute care bundle. I think that'll be great. But there, I mean, it's a perfect example of shambolic mess that David Brooks was talking about. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, you are not going to be able to cut out 30 to 40% of your costs in the old-fashioned way. You're just not going to be able to do that. Or you're really, I mean, you'll have to give up two of your three missions, and you'll probably have to significantly mitigate your caregiving mission. And that's just not acceptable. So if you think about that, you basically have to say, what is it we're going to be able to do to get that 30 to 40% of cost that doesn't bring benefit? How can we capture some of that? What am I going to have to do governance-wise, fiduciary? What am I going to have to do tactically in order to get at some of that 30 to 40%, because otherwise we're going to be up the creek, I think. And I don't have the answer to that, but I'm certainly willing to noodle with you about it. And Laura, the concept of the annuity, that is, if we take better care of diabetic patients over here, won't they eventually have to die of something? And is it possible that they'll all get neurodegenerative disease, and then that'll really cost society? You know, that's why we have academics. I'm just a little guy out there trying to make incremental difference, and thank God I don't have to think those thoughts. So thank you again, David. Really appreciate it.
Well, colleagues, I want to take a moment first to thank David, Doris, and Ray for coming. It's just so wonderful to have you seated in the front row. I want to thank Darlene Schief and Alexis Skoufalos and her entire team. It's very important for me to thank the dean's staff, Dr. Carolyn Golob, Alexis, David Glatter, and our program directors, in addition to Drew, again, Dr. Rob Simmons, Dr. Jim Pellegano, Dr. Joe Jackson, and Dr. Diana Batamarco. I am blessed to have an incredible, hardworking team. I hope many of you, having enjoyed today, will join our Grandin Society. A year ago, with help from the Development Office, Fritz and Molly and others, we created this membership organization for persons both on and off campus as a development vehicle, as a membership organization for people to share with us and all of the excitement and work we do in a collaborative education model, and to promote innovation in everything that we're about. I hope you'll stop by our beautiful booth in the lobby to learn more about the Grandin Society on your way out of this beautiful building. Well, colleagues, we hit a home run, a beautiful day, a crowded, beautiful Connolly Auditorium in the Hamilton Building. Let me wish you Godspeed. The 22nd annual Grandin Lecture is concluded. Thank you very much.